Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show, online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming back my co-host, a man who himself is quite a basketball player, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you, Bip.
So, you know, we've heard a lot about how Arne Duncan now makes this cabinet perhaps the best basketball-playing cabinet in America's history. But people often say, you know, if they were putting together a pickup team of basketball players, of education wonks, that they would want Rick Hess on their side.
I'm flattered. I'm not sure I understand it. Vertical leap of about a half an inch. But I'm flattered. Who else in the cabinet besides Arne makes up for this this five-man squad?
You know, that's a good question. There was I saw some paper that there were five or six people that have played basketball somewhat seriously that are on the
cabinet. Thinking Hillary Clinton? Or
I don't know if Hillary's part of that. I don't remember hearing that part of her bio. I don't know. Was Rahm Emanuel? I have no idea.
Isn't he missing part
Janet
of a finger?
Janet Napolitano, maybe?
She strikes me as a tough lady. Put her in the number two. Let her post up.
None of us know this answer. I don't know.
We'll so we're just talking out of our league here.
You know what? So lots of exciting news, Rick. We've got a new Secretary of Education designate named. We've got.
And I saw you on television talking about the new secretary.
You did not see me on television.
I heard that you're on television talking about it.
Yes. When I told you I was on the NewsHour, what was your response, Rick? what's that?
No. I think I inquired whether that is a television show.
Okay. Well, that was pretty good. It's not like you don't watch television.
I just don't watch this PBS stuff. I tend to stick to, you know, commercial television and
that's right.
No, cable shows.
I was on the NewsHour with Edgywonk Andy Rotherham. Mm. So that was a lot of fun.
And who got the? Was this like a debate?
Not so much. More of a discussion with Ray Suarez about the future challenges that Arne Duncan's going to face.
Oof! And imagine me missing that on my recreational.
You can go online and you can listen to it.
Ooh!
All right. Okay.
Twice.
Okay. So, lots to cover today. Of course, we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear the Research Minute. We're going to rate that reform, and we're really going to pack it in, Rick, because I believe it's going to be now several weeks until we're back on the air.
Really?
Because of the holiday break. That's right. I know our listeners are going to go through some withdrawal over the holidays. You can always go back and listen to old Education Gadfly shows, you know? I mean, a lot of this stuff is timeless.
Easily.
All right, but let's make sure this show, we really want to knock it out of the park today, Rick, because it's going to have to sustain people well into January. Okay, so Chris, Christina, let's get started.
President-elect Obama has selected Arne Duncan to be his Secretary of Education.
Slam dunk.
What's the significance? Does this mean that Obama is a reformer, a conciliator, a basketball fanatic? What?
It's a lot of questions. I think it means that the guy's a good politician. He had this challenge. He had the Democrats' Red Reform Wing, who are very enthusiastic about charters and merit pay, of course. He had the unions on the other side, and particularly the leading champion, Linda Darling Hammond, of professionalization. Arne Duncan was the one choice outside maybe of a Jim Hunt or somebody from outside the box who was actually going to keep the peace with both wings. And, you know, and everybody's able to read into the Duncan choice the Obama they like best.
That's right. I mean, almost everybody loves this pick. I've seen some statements from folks on the what I would call the loony left that are angry about it, that think he's too much in favor of accountability and things like that. But he's definitely a kind of middle of the road pick. It confirms what we already knew about President-elect Obama, which is that he has reform instincts, and he's happy to talk about reform ideas like charter schools, like overhauling failing schools. And he had some pretty strong things to say about that in the announcement the other day. But at the same time, he's a diplomat. He doesn't go out of his way to poke people in the eye or to pick fights with key constituencies within his party or even across the aisle. But it doesn't really tell us much more about where they're going on policy. You know, during this announcement the other day, the phrase "no child left behind" did not come up once. And that, of course, is the major job duty of Arne Duncan, is to figure out how to update that law.
Part of what this means is that we're just going to still keep having to wait and see who the full slate of appointments for the department turns out to be. Have to see what that first budget proposal looks like, see what winds up being in the stimulus package for education. You know, when you look at Duncan's record in Chicago, what you see is pretty much everybody can point to things they like. The Teach for America crowd and charter folks can point to alternative licensure efforts and to Renaissance 2010. But also the union can say, hey, the Chicago Teachers Union said they like working with this guy.
That's right.
He's, you know, works hard at building community relationships. And one of the interesting things is how any of this translates to D.C.
Right, right.
Duncan's skill set is that he seemed to know half of Chicago, that he had a ton of local credibility. He's not going to have those same resources when he comes to D.C. It'll be interesting to see how he leads.
You know, one last point. I do think that you have to say that this was a nice tribute to Rod Paige. You know, because, you know, here he was broke the mold. You know, he was the model here. An urban superintendent becomes education secretary. He's gotten a lot of flack about things that have happened when he was there. But here they, you know, again, decide to go for an urban superintendent. I think that was a nice sign.
Next one. The Washington Post ran a big Sunday front pager about the D.C. charter school movement, alleging that the chairman of the D.C. charter school board was guilty of conflicts of interests. His bank provides financing for many of the schools he oversees. Is this a fair concern, or did the Post miss the boat?
So this is part of a larger series the Post has running, and they also had a big piece on student achievement in charter schools that we can get to. But this really drives me crazy. This the head of the D.C. Charter School Board, the chairman, in a volunteer position, Tom Nina, he is a banker here in town, and he has been an evangelist getting the word out to other bankers about why they should at least give charter schools the time of day and try to, you know, see if they can work with them making some deals on charter school facilities. As everybody that knows this issue well knows, facilities has been the huge stumbling block for charter schools. Most places, they don't have money for it. Banks, you know, look at them and say, you look like a huge risk. We're not interested in working with you. And Nida's tried to go out there and explain to people, look, you know, you really, this is an opportunity. And what does he do? He goes voluntarily into this public office to serve on this board, doing a great job. DC's charter schools are known as among the best in the country. And he gets punished by this front page article that says that he's profiting from this work. You know, what do they want? They want people that don't know.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem here is you think of any kind of municipal area, there's not only a limited number of people who are in the banking community who are going to be interested in education, who are doing property or development deals. So if you want people who actually understand these issues to wind up serving on these boards, you know what? The likelihood is some of the deals in which they're engaged are going to wind up having them sitting at different ends of the table. Obviously, you need some transparency. You need appropriate oversight. Sure, it creates possibilities for concern. But the reality is, if you say, look, we don't want anybody who understands this stuff who's involved in it at the table, then what we ensure is either people who don't know anything about these challenges or making the decisions, or it's a bunch of public officials who aren't particularly well suited for, you know, the challenges this stuff poses.
Right. And you know, so we have on the Sunday above the fold headline, it's, you know, public office, private gain, very scandalous. And then, oh, on Monday, by the way, the charter schools are performing quite well.
So let's stay with that just for a second. One of the things that's a little frustrating here is this charter school performance story was the exact same story that caused such a hullabaloo a couple years back when the AFT did its NAEP analysis of charter performance, leaked it to the New York Times, you know, and Gene Shimo wrote that big story, and there was an outcry from charter advocates about how this is a ludicrous way to assess charter performance.
Because it was just comparing charter school performance with traditional public schools, one snapshot in time using the national assessment.
And we don't know to what degree this is caused by selection effects or who's attending these schools or anything else.
You're saying this is the same way
they did the analysis. Story in reverse, and it's a little, you know, I'm real disappointed that some of the same charter supporters who were so vocal about the need for reasonable standards about using research, when the Times ran the story slanted one way, weren't making the same principled critique when the Post slanted the story the other way.
Mm-hmm. Fair point.
Last one. Oregon has scrapped its plans to require high school students to pass a math test in order to graduate, citing the financial strains from the recession. It seems that schools don't have the money to provide tutoring and the like to help students pass the test. Is this a smart move, or do high school kids need to know math even in bad economic times?
I think math is one of those economy optional things. In good times, sure. In bad times, reading and writing is probably enough.
Yeah, that's right. We have to economize.
This is just ludicrous.
It's totally ludicrous. But here's what I got to wonder. I suspect that there is a lawyer behind this that's worried about a lawsuit. Mm. I mean, we know that there have been states that have been sued because of having high-stakes tests, graduation tests. People sue and say, well, it's not fair because kids didn't learn what's on those tests. And the courts have said, look, as long as you are providing a lot of supports to help kids pass these tests, remedial education, tutoring, and the stuff, you're okay. And if the state of Oregon is saying, well, we don't have the money for that kind of stuff right now, perhaps they're worried about a court challenge. That's all I can think of. you know, I mean, otherwise, how can you justify that you're just going to say, well, forget about our higher standards. We're just going to give up on that.
You know, what's so crazy about this is states and districts across the country are in tough financial times right now. And one of the few, perhaps the only bright side of these fiscal difficulties is it creates the opportunity and the political cover to take tough steps. Things that you can't do when times are good, you can do. Well, what do we see Oregon doing? They finally have the opportunity and the political cover to make some tough steps. And what do? They do the easy stuff. They throw the standards overboard.
Mm-hmm.
This is just such a disheartening development.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now here time for Amber and her Research Minute. Amber, I see you're here all decked out. In your holiday garb, ready for Fordham's holiday party tonight.
Is this what we would call a garbage? Uh-oh. Give it up.
It's a groaner.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, so do we have a holiday-oriented research
minute?
Oh, I wish
we did. I just didn't think that creatively. I'm sorry to report.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, maybe you can find a way to weave into your 60 seconds some allusions to the holiday spirit that we're all a part of.
60 seconds, yeah.
All right, okay, Amber. What's the topic?
The topic is teacher quality.
Okay, 60 seconds on teacher quality.
All right, there's an exciting study out recently that fills a huge void in the teacher quality research. Namely, what impact do teacher preparation programs have on student achievement via the performance of their graduates? It's a first-rate value-added study conducted by LSU professor George Knoll for the Louisiana Board of Regents. It examines 7 teacher preparation programs in Louisiana, including 5 university-based programs and 2 private providers. Researchers used a student-teacher linked data set that included achievement data from 2004 to 2007 for all grade 4 through 9 students. Suffice it to say, it's a very well-executed study, and the results showed that 1 alternative provider of teacher education, that would be the New Teacher Project, and 2 university-based programs demonstrated consistent positive results for students across countem 4 content areas. The New Teacher Project, in fact, did especially well preparing math teachers who outperformed their more experienced teachers in this subject by high margins. Finally, the report makes a strong case for increased accountability of teacher preparation programs, and it provides great evidence for the need to extend teacher prep providers beyond the walls of education schools.
Very nicely said, Amber. Whew.
Was that a minute?
I think TNTP is needed in Oregon, baby.
I think that's right. That's right. That was a little over a minute. But again, I'm in the holiday spirit.
That was tight. That seemed like 45 seconds.
It did. It was tight. So let's talk about this. Mm-hmm. All right. So the New Teacher Project, which specializes in recruiting mid-career professionals, typically, right? It did particularly well, as well as some of the education school programs, the traditional programs. Now, do we know, is this because they are recruiting people that might have greater intelligence?
Well, they did look, they controlled for some of their ACT, graduate school, GRE, some of that kind of stuff. And they also did this technique called propensity score matching, where the comparison group was sort of, they looked at the composition of the comparison group's class to make sure that it was the same composition as the new teachers' classes coming out of these programs. Mm-hmm. So in other words, some of that stuff that you're worried about was sort of taken into consideration in the study.
But that's even more interesting. So that means that there's actually something about the training itself that is
That's why I said it was a well-executed first.
An interesting wrinkle on this, though, is that there might be, say, life experiences that TNT people bring to the table, even beyond native ability, which a well-designed professional development program can tap.
Yeah,
right. Ed schools, when they do alternative licensure, it's the same licensure in different configurations.
Right.
One of the interesting questions this poses is, Maybe people who've been doing something for 20 years are actually better potential teachers than kids fresh out of college if we figure out how to actually provide them with effective development.
Which is why I don't know that I would even say you'd have to control for those other factors. I mean, if that's part of the program is trying to go after people who have, you know, score higher on ACTs and things like that, that seems to be part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I just think as far as the design, when you want to make sure you've got a good comparison group, you need to take into that stuff.
Well, and you really want the summative effects. You want to know how big the bang is from the program.
Yep.
You want to know how much it matters who you recruit.
Yep.
And then we can think about, the quality problem is how do you kind of maximize both of these?
Well, this is very exciting.
It's a very exciting study.
And what is the song that's going
to
go along with
song,
this?
The song, so they're getting ready to teach, teacher preparation programs. So we're listening to Get Ready by the Rare Earth Band. And this is from the 70s, so mood for a little disco.
Get ready to
Very it's not really disco, but it's 70s, and it's got a nice sound on it.
I like that. We should play that tonight at the holiday party. Laura, can you cue that up?
It's good stuff.
I
was expecting Boston, Get Ready.
I have to say, I thought you said that the song was Get Ready, and I think it was actually Get Ready. I just want to point that out.
Oh,
I'm just kidding. That was unfair. I was making fun of Amber's
accent.
That wasn't nice of Amber. All right.
Especially in this season of joy.
Now I feel like a Grinch. Amber, I apologize. That was uncalled for.
Yeah, all right. I accept it.
All right. All right, Amber with her Research Minute. Thank you, Amber.
You're welcome.
That's good stuff.
Wow. Rick, it's usually you putting your foot in your mouth.
Oh.
Oh, no, I was... I've insulted you, too.
Not in this holiday of joy. I try to bring the love, baby.
You do bring the love. Hey, when do your people start your celebration?
People?
Yeah, you know.
Meaning AEI?
No, you know, the Hanukkah thing.
The Jewish?
Yes, yeah, the people of your faith. The chosen ones, you know.
The Jewish people?
You are a part of the Jewish people in that case.
Anyway.
When does that start? Is it an early? I mean, sometimes it always bounces around.
It floats because it's, of course, on the Hebraic calendar.
Right.
Which isn't real synchronized with our. And because of the larger biases and disinterest in the larger society, you always have to look for that little box in the corner.
You don't know when Hanukkah starts?
It's confusing. So, Stafford, what do you got?
Well, actually, today I'm back with another edition of Rate That Belt-Tightening Reform. So this story comes just from New Jersey, where multiple pieces of legislation have been recently introduced in the state legislature that would allow ads on the side of school buses. The advertisers would be picked on the district level, with the State Commissioner of Education retaining the final veto right. So anything having to do with alcohol, tobacco, or political advocacy would be banned. And while no estimates have yet been made in New Jersey, it seems the financial potential for this plan is quite large. One district in Colorado, which has had the ads for about 15 years now makes between $130,000 and $150,000 a year from ad sales. Apparently, at least six other states already allow ads, either on the sides or the insides of buses themselves. But having these ads on the insides or the sides have both met with some criticism. One district transportation director, from New Jersey actually, worried that drivers would look at the ads on the buses and be distracted. He explains, quote, "I don't want people to look at school buses and read the signs. I want people to see the school bus and say, whoops, I better stop," end quote. Ads on the inside of buses have been accused of unfairly targeting the captive audience of malleable young minds that are its passengers. But neither of these criticisms seems a game stopper to me. And New Jersey is in a financial pinch, so I hope they're not game stoppers for the legislators either. Mm-hmm. So I gave this an A on both counts for realizing that they need to tighten their belts and for coming up with a good idea to do so.
You know, and frankly, when I see like a billboard, I still say, whoops, I better stop. I rarely drive into billboards.
Wait, you just stop in the middle of the highway? Doesn't that cause all kinds of problems?
I try to steer away from large billboards or large, like, you know, when I see like those big U-Haul vans with U-Haul on the side.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I'm going to drive into that and see what it feels like. Right. I still try to steer away from it.
Like, oh, that's interesting. It's from New Mexico. Oh, look at this. First of all, I mean, this has been happening forever, right, in municipal buses. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that causes any big problem in terms of traffic. Now, the more tricky question is this question about inside. Now, also this week, the Montgomery County, Maryland, here outside Washington, D.C., announced that they were getting rid of the bus radio service. This is something that's kind of like Channel 1 is for schools with televisions. This is a commercial service that pipes in pop music and stuff into school buses and then plays some advertisements. And the schools get some money, and then it's also, gives the bus driver a way to, I guess, sound an emergency alarm if something's happening. So. And parents complain about the malleable young minds thing again. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one advocacy group said that this was a bad idea because otherwise the kids would be enjoying quiet reflection on their bus ride to school.
They've clearly spent a lot of time on school buses.
I mean, Rick, did you ever spend quiet reflection time on your way to school?
I do remember them people tearing the seats apart to throw styrofoam at the kid with curly hair, but that's about it.
Were you the kid with curly hair?
No, fortunately, not that one.
Well, thank you, Stafford, for that reform. And, Rick, I just want to say Happy New Year to you and to yours.
Mike, it's been another fantastic year on the podcast.
It has been.
Merry Christmas to you. Happy holidays. Happy New Year and all that good stuff.
I love you, buddy.
It's a beautiful thing. We'll look forward to doing it again in 2009.
All right. Till 2009.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net. Signing off.